Welcome to Trust Radio, the investment trust podcast brought to you by Janus Henderson Investors. I'm Andrew Chiguri, and in this episode, I'll be discussing valuations with John Bennett, Core Portfolio Manager of the Henderson European Focus Trust. This episode is brought to you in association with Janus Henderson Investors. It's for promotional purposes, is not for onward distribution, and the value of an investment can fall as well as rise. Past performance is not a guide to future performance, and nothing in this episode should be construed as advice. Anything said in this episode is the view of the fund manager when we recorded and may have changed as events have developed over time. Our discussion is for illustrative purposes only, and references made to individual securities should not constitute or form part of any offer or solicitation to issue, sell, subscribe, or purchase the security.
So Tom, though volatility has been more subdued in 2021 compared to 2020, it has still been a tricky year for investors. Could you provide us with a recap of 2021 and how you navigated the market environment?
Yeah, well, look, I suppose the first thing to acknowledge is that we're speaking now on the 1st of December, and over the last week, volatility has definitely ramped up in the market again, thanks to Omicron. And that caps, yeah, a pretty stressful and volatile year. Like you said, less dramatic than 2020 because you didn't have the scale of the sell-off that we saw in March 2020. But still, in many ways, this year has actually been trickier. In terms of our portfolio construction, we always use that chart with the circles on when we're presenting to investors, and it highlights that we invested in the industrial V-shaped recovery in 2020 from the second quarter, and that served us nicely. And then towards the end of 2020 and into 2021, we transitioned more to the consumer V-shape. So people with high savings rates would emerge from government restrictions and spend all their money on nice things, nice experiences, holidays, and whatnot. And that's still where we are today. That's where we believe the recovery is still coming through, still to come through. And that's important because over the last week, the market's done what it usually does, which is shoot first, ask questions later. And it's sold off a lot of these, perhaps more value tilted in factor style, but certainly more consumer reopening names. And well, there are a couple of reasons why we think that that's overdone. And the fundamental reason is that we don't think it leads to demand destruction. At worst, it leads to demand deferral. So governments might do what they've been doing and reintroduce certain measures, certain frictions on economic activity or consumer economic activity. But ultimately, they will be relaxed and people will still come out and spend the money that they've not fully had the opportunity to spend yet. So we see moments like last week and earlier this week, big sell-off in the market as really an opportunity to lean into it a bit more, because we are a closed-end fund, so we can be patient. And also we have the option of gearing. You know, that's the other thing that's really special about the trust structure and about HEFT, is when we think the market sell-off or a particular area of the market has sold off and it's far too excessive and it's based on short-term trading flows, short-term factors, which I can elaborate on a little bit, we can use ability to gear to lean into that and really capitalize on that recovery. And at the minute, we're pretty low on our gearing. We're sub 1% geared. We tend not to be a highly geared trust through the cycle anyway, certainly compared to some peers. About the highest we took it was March 2020, when you had that rapid sell-off. We took gearing up to about 7%, I think it was. And that was pretty high for us. And once that market recovery came in, we managed that gearing back down to low single digits. And as I said, right now we're in a position where if the market does continue to sell off on what we think are short-term factors, we can lift that gearing to capitalize on the recovery. Now, why do we think it's short-term factors? The asset management industry is obviously, it has its quirks. And one of them is the year end. It's an arbitrary point in time, really, for long-term capital growth. But for the industry, it's, you know, the annual moment of performance measurement. And so you get a lot of risk aversion actually into year end, because people don't want to undo all the hard work that they've done, or hopefully the good performance that they've achieved through the year. And so risk tolerance really reduces. And then you get something like this towards the end of the year, you know, this sort of potential risk event and the uncertainty that it entails. And people just go, right, I don't want to take any risk here. And they, you know, it becomes about avoidance. The other thing on top of that is trading volumes are often dominated by market participants with a very short-term time horizon. So it's hedge funds. And they really are measured on short-term time horizons. You know, it's the year end, it's the end of the quarter, it's the end of the month. It might be performance to, you know, up until lunchtime that matters. It can be really short-term. And again, that can mean that trading activity doesn't really reflect the fundamental changes to a company's outlook. It's simply, what have I got to do to get me over the line to the next point of performance measurement? And then the final thing on top of that is really that many of these flows are highly levered. So, you know, a hedge fund book might be 100 million euros. It can be levered up to 500 million euros. You know, they'll borrow 3 to 4 times leverage against that in order to amplify the returns, but obviously it can amplify the losses. And when volatility in the market picks up, the houses that run these levered risk models, they monitor it very, very closely. When volatility rises, they have to take leverage down. And what that means then is that when leverage is coming out of the stock market, it leads to selling. They have to sell their positions to be able to pay back the debt. So that's why we think there's a lot of short-term factors going on here. And why we think for a lovely, patient, closed-end vehicle like HEFT that can gear into it, it's just an opportunity to take advantage. So in terms of how we navigated this year, I would say we still believe in that consumer V-shape. The difficult thing to navigate has been that despite inflation quite obviously becoming less and less transitory. And I think even yesterday, Powell in the US said, yeah, we probably need to retire that transitory term now. It doesn't have, or it has not had, the impact on the yield curve and therefore the perceived cost of capital increase that would benefit value stocks. It's not had the impact that we might have expected. And in fact, since about Q2 this year, that was about the peak for the value recovery. And since then, it's become much trickier. The market's become narrower. It's been a real sort of reversion to low vol, quality, growth type stocks. And that's despite inflation looking, if not structurally now, higher for the foreseeable future, for the medium term and so on. It's looking a lot less transitory, you know, and despite that, we've not had perhaps the market shape development that we might have expected.
It's interesting. You've touched on the consumer reopening play there for 2020 and coming into 2021. In which other sectors did you find, you know, some of the best opportunities? And, you know, more importantly, are there any segments of the market that you're invested in that you didn't, you know, that didn't behave as you expected?
Yes. So I would say overall, what hasn't behaved in the way we would have expected is the market, the growth versus value disconnect, despite inflation looking less transitory. And then along with that, you know, it's those sectors that are very, very cheap, but perhaps have more value characteristics that haven't perhaps behaved in the way we would have liked them to behave in through processes of earnings upgrades. So that's been tricky. It's more of a market observation overall, I think. Well, there are a few interesting observations here. Despite the market perhaps not behaving with respect to inflation and the yield curve in the way we would have liked, It's also notable that two of the top performing sectors are tech, as you would expect in a narrow market that just prioritizes growth, but also banks. And banks are the ultimate macro play on inflation coming back. Arguably, it's because they were coming from such a low base that there's plenty of scope for them to recover this year. But it's interesting that your top two sectors are the polar opposites, you know, in terms of that market shape. Now, the sector that I think specifically really interests me and is one that's relevant to how we've behaved with the trust is the oil sector. It's a real value sector, and it's been given an extra kick in from the sort of ESG brigade that say you can't own fossil fuels of any type, even if they are responsible Western listed companies that are doing all of the right things or doing the best they can with regard to the energy transition. That's one we started to, we actually were on zero oil exposure until about the end of Q3, early Q4 2020. And we thought this sector's really starting to look interesting. It's cheap. It's got a recovery aspect to it in the short term. People start traveling again, people start flying again. It's got a really interesting medium-term setup, which flies in the face of, I suppose, that ESG-driven narrative of oil's going away, it's going to die. And that is that population growth is coming in most of the countries where there isn't going to be a quick energy transition. They can't afford it. They're going to need a lot of fossil fuels. And to actually deprive them of that asks a lot of questions about, you know, well-being and standards of living and so on. So the medium-term outlook's actually very strong for fossil fuels, for oil and gas. But the big thing was the capital discipline. These management teams, a lot of them came through and said, look, yes, we're under a lot of pressure from external stakeholders and investors telling us that we need to become Greta friendly. But what they were saying was, we're not going to waste money on expensive wind turbines. Nor are we going to plow loads of money upstream into oil and gas because we're not going to be rewarded for it. So we're just going to give the money back to shareholders through buybacks, through dividends and so on. And that's a trend that's really continued this year. But it had a good start to 2021 and then it just sort of stopped working for a while, despite the oil price having gone up about 40, 50%. And again, it got so extreme that into September, John and I sat down and we were, you know, basically crying into our pints and going, that this value disconnect is looking really extreme again, despite all of the things we're reading about inflation, despite the oil sector, actually the management team saying a lot of the right things that should reassure investors in that sector. And we said, look, we don't think this is sustainable. So we actually took oil up again into September. And it was pure luck that the timing was right before we had the oil and gas price spike, you know, and the concerns about energy costs and all of that stuff, which I think has actually thrown a bit of a spanner in the works in terms of the binary nature of the energy transition debate at the minute. I think it's starting to make people realize that there's a cost to this. And there's the need for an orderly transition. But perhaps we can come on to that. But in any case, we got in September and then obviously we got the price rally in oil and gas. And that led to the sector performing quite well again. Now, they're still dirt cheap. You know, these are still stocks on 15% plus free cash flow yields in some cases. So that's a payback period that would imply these companies are dying quite quickly within the next 10 years and have no terminal value, even though a lot of them have built wind farms and things that will presumably last many decades. So the oil sector is one that I think has been a really interesting case study this year. And we specifically in the trust, we have one of the big boys, Total, listed in France, but more specific to the trust relative to our other funds. is Lundin Energy, which is about a $10 billion company. So it's hard to fit into some of our bigger CCAV OEIC funds because there just isn't the liquidity in it. But again, the trust being the smaller closed-end fund, it can accommodate lower market cap companies and it can accommodate lower liquidity companies. So we don't need that daily trading flow as much if we're high conviction on that stock. And Lundin, just the other day, a headline hit suggesting they're looking to sell the company. And so the stock went up 10, 11%. And I think that's really interesting. And I think 2022 is going to be a really interesting time for this sector because people are now aware that energy prices are probably going to go up on the back of this energy transition. And there's a real issue in the West of security of supply for fossil fuels because we're still going to need them for a long time. And if you look at the German coalition last week, they said, look, we're going to need to build a load more gas power generation to be able to wean ourselves off coal and nuclear. So we're going to need gas for a long time. There's a strategic security of supply issue. So we're going to need Western listed, responsible fossil fuel companies for a long, long time. And I think, or I hope, that that's going to come more into the debate. Lundin looking to sell itself, to take itself off market, should make us all ask ourselves some questions about what's really important here. Is it to banish emissions from our portfolios and force these companies off market into private hands, into less accountable areas? Do we want to be dependent on local oligarchs in various parts of the world to be giving us gas and oil, which we're going to need for a long, long time? Or actually, is it better to stop having a beauty contest about the emissions of our portfolio as it stands and think a bit more carefully about an orderly transition? So oil, we still like it because the fundamentals are there, the demand outlook, the management teams are saying the right things. And maybe, just maybe, there's a bit of a critical reappraisal because people go, actually, we do need these things on the listed markets. They're going to be around for a long, long time. Let's keep them there and perhaps, therefore, let's own them. And that's the final point I wanted to make here, which is we are not making any heroic assumptions about the oil sector in our weighting. We're actually about 50, 60 basis points overweight the benchmark in oil, which is, I think, the low 4% at the minute. Might have altered a little bit given the market performance since Omicron hit. But that's there or thereabouts where we are, moderately overweight. But the big distinction is that we are significantly overweight, I believe, relative to our peer group. Most people do not own oil and gas, partly for ESG, partly because the weighting has shrunk over the years. It used to be a huge part of the index. Now it's not. So it's not necessarily a big bet that you've been taking to avoid oil when it's in the sort of mid-single digit range weighting in the benchmark, especially then with the ESG overlay and the fact that it's very much been a growth market for 10 years, which hasn't favoured sectors like oil. So we're not hugely overweight the bench, but I think we are being more brave than perhaps many of the long-only managers out there. And I think next year is going to get quite interesting.
You've touched on a few very interesting points there, you know, that value versus growth rotation and also COVID. We've got also inflation continue to grind higher, policy tightening, supply chain issues, and higher energy prices posing a risk to the global economic recovery and markets. What do you see as the most underappreciated risk?
So I think, this might be just banging my head against a brick wall here because I've just said that the market doesn't seem to care for the fact that inflation is looking less transitory. That makes me think it's still an underappreciated risk. The thing I have to mull over in my head is, no matter what gets thrown at the yield curve, you know, whether it's more and more inflation, does it make the yield curve move, and therefore does it prompt the equity market to respond to that regarding its shape, you know, between growth and value? Maybe the answer is just no, and that's something we need to think carefully about. But I do think inflation as a whole continues to be an underappreciated risk. And you've got lots of debate around this, because some of the stuff probably is transitory. Used car prices, you know, they're bonkers at the minute because people can't get new cars. They're waiting 6 months. So if you need a car, you've got to go into a secondhand market. I can understand how that fades as the automotive manufacturers get the semiconductors that they need to produce more cars and get them to customers more quickly. I can understand that. So there are some temporary factors that maybe we do have to accept will be looked through by the market. But I think wage inflation is something that still seems to be relatively underappreciated. I was reading a great stat the other day, which is in September in the US, 3% of the workforce resigned. And I've spoken recently, I've had meetings with the CFO of Randstad, which is a big temporary staffing company based in the Netherlands, but global operations. And then about 3 days later, actually, I had a call with the CFO of Adecco, which is Randstad's direct listed peer. And they both talked about that propensity to move, to exploit, you know, wage inflation in certain sectors or to retrain and go to other sectors. There's a lot of friction in the jobs market at the minute. And I think a couple of other things have made it easier for people to move. Well, first of all, they have the motivation. COVID's probably led to people going, actually, it's given me a lot of time to think about my circumstances in my life, and I don't want to be in this job anymore or this sector. I want to move. But increasingly, these staffing companies talk about how everything is done more or less virtual. So if you just think the practicalities of in the past, if you wanted to go for a job interview, you had to get suited and booted up and make an excuse to be out of office or book a day off or whatever and slope off to a prospective new employer. It was quite difficult to do. And now you can just do your quick Zoom call, can't you? So I think the barriers to moving jobs has probably changed, have reduced. And then the other thing, I suppose, is that work from home effect again, which has increased the proximity within which you as an employer can gather candidates. So again, Randstad were telling me about the fact that now, because of there's loads of demand for tech workers in the US, all of that stuff. Whereas Seattle tech wages are much, much higher. Places like Dallas are still expensive, but they're lower wage areas. But now they're able to gather candidates from Dallas to be effectively working remotely, doing that job that would have pre-pandemic been physically based in Seattle. So there's a lot going on in that labour market, and there's a lot of friction because, as we know, there's a lot of shortages of certain jobs, certain skills, and so on. So I don't see wage inflation particularly getting any easier, and if anything, it probably gets worse because there's a lot of psychology around the jobs market, isn't there? And once that sets in, once people realise they can get wage increases, the employers are on the back foot, they can push for more. So feels like the terms of trade have shifted a little bit in that market, and that's really going to put pressure on inflation. So that would be probably the biggest underappreciated risk, I think, for the inflation debate, because it just might be the more structural component of inflation. Possibly on top of that, going back to the oil sector, is we've not really had a fully recovered global economy yet, and oil still spiked to above $85 a barrel. That might mean that if, as and when, governments allow us all to travel post-Omicron, that a fully recovered global economy might see oil prices and therefore energy prices and the cost of inputs into manufactured materials and so on even higher. So maybe there's another leg on that front. But certainly from a structural perspective, I think wages are going to be a really interesting area. Like I said, the huge caveat here, Andy, is that the inflation or the outcome in the yield curve and the equity market from increased inflation hasn't really played out in 2020, and maybe it won't.
All of that summed up with regards to that kind of risk, what is your outlook for the year, for 2022?
Look, I think high level, there are still reasons to be quite positive equity markets, especially after the sell-off we've just had over the last couple of days. But there's a lot of excess liquidity in the system still, even if the Fed is talking about tapering. There's a lot of good value in the stock market. You know, we talk about stock markets at all-time highs and all of that stuff, which does make people nervous. And it also means it probably exacerbates the kind of sell-off that we've just seen, because the market's getting jittery and people are looking for an excuse to have a bit of a panic. And that's quite normal in the course of any year. You get a couple of drawdowns like that. But there's still actually a lot of good value in the market. And, you know, we like I said, oil stocks are on nearly 20% free cash flow yields. Mining companies are on well over 10% free cash flow yields, even with the recent pullback in commodity prices. Steel companies, 25, 30% free cash flow yields. There's a lot of value in the market, and the equity market is often the best place for inflation protection. So if inflation is stronger for longer, is less transitory than we've all been led to believe, then your equity market is the best place to get the protection from that. Not necessarily in super high multiple growth stocks, which get their mojo from ever lower cost of capital, but from companies that are fundamentally able to pass on the higher costs of production into the price at which they sell their products. Inflation, maybe with some lags between the cost you pay and when you can price up your products, but largely speaking, over time, inflation should be a pass-through. So it's a good place for inflation protection, and there are still many, many corners of the market that are not being valued appropriately. And so I'm still, you know, I'm always optimistic on equity markets. That's why I work in them. I think, you know, they're a fantastic place to generate a sustainable return on capital over and above anything you'd get by putting it in the bank or in fixed income over time. So I'm quite optimistic on that always. So maybe, you know, I'm just biased and talking my own book, but I do see plenty of values on the table still. That reminds me of another point to mention here, and this is something to look out for in 2022, is I would still expect to see a lot of private equity taking companies off market. There are a number of sectors and a number of companies that the equity market arguably is fundamentally failing to value appropriately. And that only goes on so long, right? That is something longer term money, be that private equity, be that family offices that don't have to do this quarterly merry-go-round of is it going to miss? Is it going to beat on earnings? And therefore, is it a short? Is it a long? They can take a more fundamental view of the value of a company. And we've seen it a lot in the UK this year, haven't we? You know, we've had UK companies left, right and centre getting picked off. Morrison's, you know, a recent high profile example of that. I think given the valuation, given that growth versus value disconnect, there are a number of companies across the European equity market, which tends to be more of a value construct anyway. They're just waiting to be picked off, I think. And I'm not going to give any specifics, but let's just say, you know, you can look companies that are not dying, but they're on over 10% free cash flow yields, all of that stuff. Companies that the narrative or the companies are a bit too diversified for a market that likes a simplicity of a story, almost a childlike simplicity of a narrative around a stock to be able to get on board with it. Those sorts of companies, they're sort of just waiting to be picked off, I think. So I think 2022 will be another lively year for, you know, those headlines. You come in the morning and you go, right, private equity company XYZ have made a bid for this company that's done nothing for 3 years in share price terms.
Well, great. Looks like we've got another interesting year ahead. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, review, and share this with anyone you think will also find this interesting. If you want to learn more about investment trusts, we have a wealth of information available on our website, which you can find in the show notes.
Glossary.
ESG, which stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. These are three criteria used to evaluate a company's ethical impact and sustainable practices. Free cash flow yield. Free cash flow yield is a financial solvency ratio that compares the free cash flow per share a company is expected to earn against its market value per share. The ratio is calculated by taking the free cash flow per share divided by the current share price. Gearing, a measure of a company's leverage that shows how far its operations are funded by lenders versus shareholders. It is a measure of the debt level of a company. Within investment trusts, it refers to how much money the trust borrows for investment purposes. Growth stocks, shares of a company which generally show above average earnings and that are expected to grow at a rate significantly above the average growth for the market. Value stocks, shares of a company that appear to trade at a lower price relative to the company's fundamentals, such as dividends, earnings, or sales. Volatility, the rate and extent at which the price of a portfolio, security, or index moves up and down. If the price swings up and down with large movements, it has high volatility. If the price moves more slowly and to a lesser extent, it has lower volatility. It is used as a measure of the riskiness of an investment. Yield curve, a graph that plots the yields of similar quality bonds against their maturities. In a normal slash upward sloping yield curve, longer maturity bond yields are higher than short-term bond yields. A yield curve can signal market expectations about the country's economic direction.
For the period of the 29th of December 2017 to the 31st of December 2018, the share price change was minus 12.3% and the net asset value change was minus 5.4%. For the period of the 30th of December 2016 to the 29th of December 2017, the share price change was 13% and the net asset value change was 8%. For the period of the 31st of December 2015 to the 30th of December 2016, the share price change was 6.1% and the net asset value change was 7.5%. The company's performance is not benchmarked against any specific stock market index. All performance, cumulative growth, and annual growth data is sourced from Morningstar.
Important information. References made to individual securities should not constitute or form part of any offer or solicitation to issue, sell, subscribe, or purchase the security. Janus Henderson Investors, one of its affiliated advisors or its employees, may have a position mentioned in the securities mentioned in the report. For promotional purposes and not for onward distribution. Before investing in an investment trust referred to in this document, you should satisfy yourself as to its suitability and the risks involved, and you may wish to consult a financial advisor. Past performance is not a guide to future performance, and the value of an investment and the income from it can fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested. Tax assumptions and reliefs depend upon an investor's particular circumstances and may change if those circumstances or the law change. Nothing in this document is intended to or should be construed as advice. This document is not a recommendation to sell or purchase any investment. It does not form part of any contract for the sale or purchase of any investment. And we may record telephone calls for our mutual protection, to improve customer service, and for regulatory record-keeping purposes. Issued in the UK by Janus Henderson Investors. Janus Henderson Investors is the name under which investment products and services are provided by Janus Capital International Limited, registration number 3594615, Henderson Global Investors Limited, registration number 906355, Henderson Investment Funds Limited, registration number 2678531, Henderson Equity Partners Limited, registration number 2606646, each registered in England and Wales at 201 Bishopsgate, London, EC2M3AE, and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority, and Henderson Management SA, registration number B22848 at 2 Rue de Bitburg, L-1273, Luxembourg, and regulated by the Commission de Surveillance du Secteur Financier. Janus Henderson, Janus, Henderson, Intech, Velocity Shares, Knowledge Shared, Knowledge Shared, and Knowledge Labs are trademarks of Janus Henderson Group PLC or one of its subsidiaries. Copyright Janus Henderson Group PLC.